The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Health and Wellness Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericahealth.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Good afternoon and welcome to Frankly Speaking About Cancer with the Cancer Support Community. Your host is Kim Tibaldo, President and CEO of the Cancer Support Community. This hour is designed to inspire, inform, and to help you live better with cancer. Now, here's your host, Kim Tibaldo.
Welcome to Frankly Speaking About Cancer, an internet radio show that focuses on informing and inspiring people to live well with cancer. I'm Kim Tibaldo, CEO of the Cancer Support Community. In 2009, the wellness community joined forces with Gilda's Club to become the Cancer Support Community, the largest provider of cancer support in the United States and around the world. Our services are offered at more than 100 locations worldwide and online at www.cancersupportcommunity.com. Our show today is sponsored in part by Lilly Oncology and AstraZeneca. We are constantly surrounded by words. Words bombard us through our screens and surround us from billboards and signs and posters and social media. And we usually forget about their presence because words are so ubiquitous to our daily lives. However, words do have the ability to influence us. They can inspire us. They can pave a way to knowledge and to discovery. Words even have the power to heal. By writing and reading about cancer, those impacted by cancer can gain perspective through self-reflection and find a sense of community through shared experiences. Joining me today on our show to talk about the healing power of words is Susan Guber, author of the book Reading and Writing Cancer, How Words Heal. Susan is an author and a distinguished emeritus professor of English at Indiana University. After being diagnosed with ovarian cancer, Susan wrote Memoir of a Debulked Woman, Enduring Ovarian Cancer, which provides intimate details about her cancer journey. Currently, Susan writes about her cancer experiences in her New York Times blog, Living with Cancer. Her blog unabashedly discusses every aspect of a life with cancer, including allowing yourself to mourn a diagnosis and to desire alternative methods of treatment. Her recent book, Reading and Writing Cancer, explains the therapeutic ways writing and reading can help those impacted by cancer by allowing them to regain a sense of self and by showing them that they aren't alone in their cancer experience. Welcome to the show, Susan.
Thank you so much.
So let's jump in, Susan. First of all, tell us a little bit about your background in the literary world.
Well, as you mentioned, I've been teaching at Indiana University. I started here in 1973, and I really only finished when the diagnosis put an end to my professional career. Probably my two better-known books are The Mad Woman in the Attic and the Norton Anthology of Literature by Women, which I co-authored both of those books with my collaborator, Sandra Gilbert.
And I know, Susan, you were diagnosed with ovarian cancer, and instead of keeping your experiences private, you've shared them in very detailed ways, including through your memoir and through the blog that you currently write for the New York Times. So why did you decide to share your experiences so openly? In fact, let's go back, and why don't you give us some history about when you were diagnosed and what that time was like for you?
I was diagnosed in 2008. And I found it a very shocking experience. I started writing really in order to remember what was happening to me because I was so estranged by the technologies, by the shock of mortality, by a diagnosis that came with a prognosis of 3 to 5 years. I was afraid that if I didn't keep a journal or a diary, I would repress or forget in a miasma of pain and anxiety. So writing for me was really a way of remembering, analyzing, conceptualizing, and taking in information that felt profoundly traumatic. Out of that diary came memoirs of a debulked woman. But the blog was a much later phenomenon. I was writing the diary, as I said, in 2008 and 9. The blogs really began in 2012. Mm-hmm. And I think my first motivation there was distress that so many women did not know the signs of ovarian cancer, that there was no early detection tool, that it was frequently misdiagnosed, and that there were very poor survival rates. So I feel like the blog was a more public kind of form of self-expression, coming out of a kind of, quite honestly, anger at the poor treatments that were available for women with this type of disease.
Can you tell us what led to your diagnosis? Were you having symptoms? And can you tell us a little bit about your treatment?
Yes, I was having a lot of symptoms, and I went repeatedly to my general practitioner, who repeatedly misdiagnosed it as irritable bowel syndrome. It was only after months of changing my diet and my exercise habits and trying prune juice and wheat germ and all kinds of other things that I was finally sent for a CT scan, and then it was stage three. I was immediately given what most ovarian cancer patients are given, a draconian form of surgery called debulking, where all of the affected organs in the abdomen are removed, and parts of the bowel, and the appendix, the spleen, the ovaries, fallopian tube, the uterus, you name it. After that, I went through various rounds of chemotherapy.
And in terms of your, you're certainly through that very difficult experience, you found the motivation, the strength to write, you know, very personal stories, but that you really intended to be shared publicly. Is that in your nature? Is that the kind of person that you are? Or was it this experience that you really felt needed to be shared?
I don't think I found the strength to share. I think I needed to share. And it was a sort of compulsion. I mean, it's the way I understand the world, is by finding the words that help me conceptualize what I'm going through. So sharing gave me strength rather than the other way around.
And in terms of the, talk a little bit more, Susan, for me about the difference between the book and the blog, the difference in what that kind of meant for you personally, the difference in how folks have kind of reacted to you or shared feedback with you. Can you talk about that process
for each, and the
differences? Yeah.
For me, the memoir was a very personal form of testifying and bearing witness. And I assumed it would be read primarily by women who were facing comparable circumstances. In my new book, I talk about memoirs and how helpful they are for people. If a man has prostate cancer and he reads a memoir about prostate cancer, he's going to find out how another person handles the problems of incontinence or impotence, right? So I think for the memoir, it was a very personal form of writing. I think the blog, it's personal, but it's also, I'm very aware of a larger public. The New York Times reaches an enormous number of readers. So I'm more aware of audience issues with the blog.
And can you talk to us about how folks have reacted to your blog? Are there people going through cancer who write to you? Are there folks who respond? Are you anything that sort of has surprised you, or any stories that sort of stand out?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the very first blog I wrote was called I Am Not a Cancer Survivor, which is pretty ironic since I was given an expiration date of 2013. But an experimental drug in a clinical trial has magically extended my life. But the response from that moment on of the readers has been just terrific. People writing themselves about how they felt that when a relative died from cancer, because of all of the survivor hype, that person was considered someone who had lost the battle. And people have been responding ever since. I learned an enormous amount from my readers. I wrote a blog on the language of cancer, the inadequate medical language, where patients are said to have failed drugs when drugs have really failed patients, or on doctors talking about minimal side effects that turn out to be maximum side effects. But I was also writing about patient language and how patients have created new words like scanxiety, about the anxiety that scans create, or about chemoflage, about the ways in which pamphlets about chemo camouflage the problems that it creates and the side effects it creates. And my readers wrote in marvelous self-identification terms. One reader described herself as a PhD, patient hasn't died. And another patient described herself as a chemo sapien, a person with chronic cancer who was going to always be on chemotherapy. So I find the reader's responses very moving, very touching, and very, very enlightening.
That's really, really fascinating. And it just seems like the blog is such an amazing vehicle to kind of have those, you know, those kinds of spontaneous interactions. You know, as you said, it's a sort of, the book was the memoir. It's sort of, it's done, it's in writing, it's out there for folks. But the, it seems like the blog really becomes an incredible opportunity for you to maybe continue to share different aspects of your experience, but also to have these sort of in the moment interactions with people, or it really gives others a vehicle to express their own thoughts and feelings about their experience. Is it sort of a living and breathing thing?
I really feel it's a great privilege and a gift in my life. I like writing it, and I love reading the comments.
Yeah, I bet. That's amazing. And can you just, we've got a couple minutes until our first break here, Susan, but can you give our listeners a little bit of an update about you and about your health? And are you feeling well? And what is your sort of continued surveillance plan?
Well, I went into this very pessimistic when I found out about the diagnosis, because I had just lost a friend from ovarian cancer. And my doctor told me 3 to 5 years, and she didn't think that a new drug in the pipeline would be ready for me when I would need it. Well, it was ready in the pipeline. It was available in a clinical trial in 12-12, 1 year before I was supposed to die. And she enrolled me in this phase 1 clinical trial. And this drug has kept me alive since.
Wow, that's amazing.
It's a remarkable story. And this drug is a targeted drug, so it does not have the side effects of chemotherapy.
And you know, I also think it's interesting. You know, your story of being diagnosed with ovarian cancer is the story of so many women, which is misdiagnosis, misdiagnosis, misdiagnosis,
right.
And that so many of the symptoms, you know, sort of mock or mirror symptoms of other, you know, diseases or conditions, including regular sort of female issues that women face. And I know that's a reason, because we don't have a blood test yet or a screening test, that's a reason why women often are diagnosed a little bit later with ovarian cancer, which, you know, I hopefully we're making some progress on that and progress on sort of, you know, better early detection of ovarian cancer. This is Frankly Speaking About Cancer. We're talking with Susan Goober. She's the author of a new book called Reading and Writing Cancer. And she has a New York Times blog called Living with Cancer. She's got a pretty amazing background that she is sharing with us, including the fact that she is an award-winning author, a distinguished emeritus professor of English at Indiana University, and she is an author and a cancer survivor. In fact, her memoir was called Memoir of a Debulked Woman in Enduring Ovarian Cancer. This is Frankly Speaking About Cancer. We're going to take a quick break, but we have a lot to discuss with Susan, so please don't go away. We'll be right back.
Cancer. It's a lonely word. Terms I don't understand. Choices I never thought I'd have to make. But there is hope and help.
Support from cancer survivors.
Links to research and clinical trials.
Help with finances and access to care.
All behind you at Breakaway from Cancer, created by Amgen to empower cancer patients.
The cancer support community is proud to be a partner of Breakaway from Cancer.
Hi. I'm Nick Nicolaides, President and CEO of Morphotech, and we're delighted to be a sponsor of Cancer Support Community's Frankly Speaking About Cancer series. Morphotech and its parent company, Eisai, are committed to human health care, and we recognize that patients and their families are the most important participants in the healthcare process. We salute our global advocacy partners who are devoted to improving the lives of people touched by cancer every day.
People living with breast cancer often find it difficult to ask for help, and many of the people in their lives want to help but don't know how. During National Breast Cancer Awareness Month, Cancer Support Community is proud to support Meal Train, sponsored by Magnolia, which utilizes MealTrain.com, a free shared online calendar, to streamline the process of giving and receiving meals for families coping with breast cancer. Help us reach our goal of 1,000 new breast cancer-specific meal trains this October. To learn more, visit MealTrain.com/MMT and enter the code MAGNOLIAB, or visit us at CancerSupportCommunity.org. Cancer Support Community is proud to be a partner of Magnolia Meals at Home, a new pilot program that aims to help patients by providing nourishing meals to households affected by breast cancer so loved ones can spend more quality time together. This program is currently available in and around two pilot cities, Andover, Massachusetts, and Woodcliffe Lake, New Jersey. Participants will receive one delivery of meals every month for up to 6 months when enrolled in the program. Each delivery includes up to 7 meals designed to help meet the nutritional needs of people living with breast cancer and 10 meals for family members. This novel program is brought to you by the Eisai Women's Oncology Program, Magnolia. Cancer Care, the Cancer Support Community, and Meals on Wheels Association of America. To find out if you or loved ones are eligible, visit online at www.magnoliameals@home.com or call 617-733-5848.
Effective cancer treatment requires more than just medication or surgery. For the country's 12 million cancer survivors and their loved ones, the social and emotional challenges of adapting to life with cancer are ongoing. How to handle coworkers' questions, how to get comfortable with new physical realities, how to reassure worried family members, or explain to friends your priorities have changed. The Cancer Support Community is ready to help by providing free counseling, education, and hope for survivors and their caregivers. Whether online or at over 100 locations around the world, the Cancer Support Community is ready to offer the support you need to live a better life with cancer. For more information on support groups, publications, nutrition, exercise programs, and more, call 1-888-793-9355 or visit us online at www.cancersupportcommunity.org. That's cancersupportcommunity.org. The Cancer Support Community, a global network of education and hope. You're listening to Frankly Speaking About Cancer with the Cancer Support Community, an inspirational program offering the resources you need to live a better life with cancer. Now here's your host, Kim Tibaldo, President and CEO of the Cancer Support Community.
Welcome back to Frankly Speaking About Cancer. I'm your host, Kim Tibaldo from the Cancer Support Community. The show today is sponsored in part by Bristol-Myers Squibb and Insight Corporation. Today we're talking about how words have the ability to heal. We've been discussing this with Susan Guber, a well-published author, including the publication of her recent book, Reading and Writing Cancer, a book on how to examine one's cancer journey by writing and reading about cancer. Susan, you're an English professor, and you've taught for many years, and that's certainly apparent in your book. You're certainly your history as a writer. You discuss writing and reading with certainly affection, with knowledge, and you do a great job really creating a bridge from the non-literary world to a place where expressing yourself with words is comfortable and, in fact, important. So we've talked a little bit about your memoir. We've talked about your blog, which we can certainly elaborate on a little bit more, and I want to make sure our listeners know where and how to find your blog. But talk about your new book, Reading and Writing Cancer. What was the inspiration for writing your recent book? What do you hope that the readers will find in those pages?
Well, I think the project, as I submitted it to the publisher, was actually just called Writing Cancer. I wanted to make it clear to people that writing could be therapeutic. it had been therapeutic for me, so I assumed it could be therapeutic for others. And I had been teaching composition for 40 years to freshmen, to graduate students, in adult education courses. The reading part came later. And the writing part came out of a sense that we learn to think in new ways by writing. W.H. Auden said, language is the mother of thought. Not the handmaiden, but the mother of thought. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me that when we find words, we find a way to conceptualize our language. When we find words about cancer, we find ways to conceptualize our experiences of cancer, which are so diverse.
And you say that writing about cancer is quote, a way to write some of cancer's grievous wrongs, to write some of cancer's grievous wrongs. Tell us about that. How does that happen?
I think in the process of writing, and of course there are all these puns here, we write, R-I-G-H-T, wrongs, because in part, writing can become a rite, R-I-T-E. It can become a ritual. It can become a form of concentration where you're quiet and you're still and you're alone and you're just with a pen and a paper or a computer file, and you're understanding your own conditions. So it seems to me that there's a zone, a concentration zone that you can get into when you're considering your own experiences through language that is not unlike what happens when you go into yoga or meditation, a sense of peacefulness and also a sense of accomplishment.
So what do you tell people, Susan, if they say, oh my gosh, I don't even know how to get started. I'm not a writer. I certainly have some thoughts about maybe what I'm going through or what my family's going through or how this has affected us, but I'm not really a writer. No one's really going to want to read what I'm writing. How do you tell somebody to get started?
Well, in the book, what I do is I provide prompts and springboards. One type of prompt is an assignment. And if you tell yourself you're going to write for 25 or 30 minutes a day, I mean, think about it. Writing is cheap. It's very inexpensive. You don't need a special place. You don't need special technologies. You're in a world of cancer where you lack control. And in the world of writing, you have total control over tone, over language. You can mock, you can laugh, you can ridicule, you can curse, you can pray. So to help people get started, let's say doing 20 or 25 minutes a day of writing, I give people either an assignment or a springboard. So would you like some examples?
I would love that. I would love that. Yes, absolutely.
Okay, so some of the examples would be remember the moment of diagnosis or telling a sibling about it, or weigh the consequences of two alternative proposed medical protocols, or let's see, celebrate a doctor or a nurse, consider your dietary or exercise goals. And then I also give these springboards, which are sort of the beginning of a sentence that you could finish and keep on writing. Here's an example. My friend responded to my cancer by, or the side effects I would never have expected surfaced as. This is something that happens to me, the issue of insomnia. Waking at 3 a.m., what do you do when you wake up at 3 a.m., which is very common with people who are depressed or anxious? Or the fact that really a diagnosis is a threshold and everything changes. So here's one springboard to get to that issue. I used to, but now I. And then finally, we change. Our physical looks change with cancer treatment. I lost all my hair. I lost a lot of weight. So when I look in the mirror, I see. What is it that you're seeing when you look in the mirror, and how do you look to yourself? Those are the kinds of sort of practices that I think can start writing for those who have not done it regularly in their lives. Many people can also go to hospitals that have writing programs because the medical research does indeed prove that writing actually alters people for the better, not only psychologically but physiologically.
So talk about that research, Susan. I know in your book you describe how in one study from the Journal of Clinical Oncology in 2014 that people with renal cell carcinoma, kidney cancer, who participated in writing were less depressed or less fatigued. Tell us a little bit more about that, about the data and what we know about that. And you know, why do you think that writing leads to these kinds of benefits?
Well, I do think that the data is overwhelming, and I think that's why there are programs at major cancer hospitals that include writing. Some of these programs, I think, help patients because people come together and discuss their writing, and then you have an audience, so you're feeling much less alone. I also feel that some people are much more private and don't want to go into those sorts of programs, and I think they can benefit simply because it seems to me that they'll be dealing with their fears. They'll be making decisions about their finances. They'll be making lists about their side effects. They'll be prioritizing their values. And they can even really talk out in the writing what they want to tell their oncologist during the next session that they've been worried about discussing with her or him. So I do think that there are all different ways in which writing can be extremely beneficial.
Do you think that it can also be a way for somebody to vent privately about maybe something or someone in their life that they wouldn't necessarily want to discuss with another person? I know, for example, one of the things that people always tell me when they're diagnosed with cancer is that they're as surprised about who does show up as they are about who doesn't show up. And sometimes they don't want to go any further and name names and things like that. But do you think it can become a way to vent kind of hurt feelings or frustration or fears?
Well, I know exactly what you're talking about because, unfortunately, I have a very, very, I would say one of my best friends disappeared in the middle of one of my crises. Yeah. And she just vanished, and this is not uncommon. I think that cancer patients very, very frequently feel a kind of anger. Actually, in the memoirs I discuss in Reading and Writing Cancer, anger and rage is a paramount theme, not just against people who have disappeared, but against misdiagnosis, about callous care in hospitals, about invasive procedures and miserable side effects. I think venting in a diary is a marvelous thing because you don't have to send the letter that you write to your friend in anger. It just stays with you, and you don't have to feel guilty, and you don't have to worry about her hurt feelings. You can just express everything that you feel.
Yeah, and just, you know, as we go to our break here, Susan, you discussed that with writing about cancer, you yourself would actually sometimes self-censor. And in what ways did you censor yourself? And
well,
how did you get over that hurdle of discussing those difficult topics sometimes?
I think the difference between a private diary and a blog that's public, there are private blogs too, but a public blog means that you're very aware of your audience and of alienating your audience. And for me, it was an issue of modesty, and I have to admit a bit of shame. I had gone through a very miserable treatment called an ileostomy, and I felt the need to be honest about it in the memoir, but I found it very difficult to discuss in the blog because it involved excremental and scatological issues that were very difficult for me to talk about in public. So I do think the issue of self-censorship is something that comes up more in public forms of writing than in private.
Mm-hmm. And so you have to think about potentially a very broad range of an audience, and how do you write to sort of the median of that audience, or to your sort of quote unquote average reader?
Well, and how do you tell the truth about your body when your body is misfunctioning or malfunctioning? How do you talk about private parts of the body that you've been taught all the time not to talk about, or only to talk about in very careful ways? And also, if you've had a miserable procedure that's made you unhappy, you don't want to scare off other patients who may also have to have that procedure.
Yeah.
So there are a lot of issues there about dealing with vulnerable people who are readers.
Yeah, absolutely. And certainly, you know, I think it must be a challenge to think about those those various filters and think about, you know, a broad audience of folks who may be reading. And like you said, where's the line, right? Where's the line in terms of scaring people, you know, rather than perhaps inspiring them or encouraging them
exactly.
to use this as a meaningful tool for themselves.
So I don't want to be his voice of doom, you know?
Right, exactly. But you don't want to sugarcoat either. So it is quite a responsibility I think you have in that role. And that's the Susan's New York Times blog called Living with Cancer. She's the author of Reading and Writing Cancer. We are going to take a quick break here. Don't go away. We have a lot more to discuss with Susan. This is Frankly Speaking About Cancer.
Cancer. It's a lonely word. Terms I don't understand. Choices I never thought I'd have to make. But there is hope and help.
Support from cancer survivors.
Links to research and clinical trials.
Help with finances and access to care.
All behind you at Breakaway from Cancer, created by Amgen to empower cancer patients.
The cancer support community is proud to be a partner of Breakaway from Cancer.
Hi, I'm Nick Nicolaides, President and CEO of Morphotech, and we're delighted to be a sponsor of Cancer Support Community's Frankly Speaking About Cancer series. Morphotech and its parent company, Eisai, are committed to human healthcare, and we recognize that patients and their families are the most important participants in the healthcare process. We salute our global advocacy partners who are devoted to improving the lives of people touched by cancer every day.
Effective cancer treatment requires more than just medication or surgery. For the country's 12 million cancer survivors and their loved ones, the social and emotional challenges of adapting to life with cancer are ongoing. How to handle coworkers' questions, how to get comfortable with new physical realities, how to reassure worried family members, or explain to friends your priorities have changed. The cancer support community is ready to help by providing free counseling, education, and hope for survivors and their caregivers. Whether online or at over 100 locations around the world, the cancer support community is ready to offer the support you need to live a better life with cancer. For more information on support groups, publications, nutrition, exercise programs, and more, call 1-888-793-9355 or visit us online at www.cancersupportcommunity.org. That's cancersupportcommunity.org. The Cancer Support Community, a global network of education and hope. You're listening to Frankly Speaking About Cancer with the Cancer Support Community, an inspirational program offering the resources you need to live a better life with cancer. Now here's your host, Kim Tibaldo, President and CEO of the Cancer Support Community.
Welcome back to Frankly Speaking About Cancer, sponsored in part today by Taiho Oncology and Celgene Corporation. I'm your host, Kim Tibaldo from the Cancer Support Community. And today we are joined by Susan Guber, author of the book Reading and Writing Cancer. Susan, this book isn't just a guide on how to write about cancer. It's also a literary conversation about other authors who've written about cancer. You know, just walk our listeners through what they can expect to find in the book.
Well, the second chapter, in terms of the book being about reading, not mm-hmm. writing, the first chapter is about writing, how to write about cancer. The second chapter is about memoirs. And I was particularly interested in memoirs of people who were dealing with very specific forms of cancer in very personal ways, and the ways in which both anger and also an effort to understand and imagine what cancer is. Those are the themes in that chapter. But I'm also interested in imaginative literature because I'm a literary critic by trade, and I was interested in what the cancer canon was. What are the poems? What are the stories? The novels and the fiction and plays that have been written about cancer, and it turned out there were quite a few. So that the third chapter is about that, about the ways in which imaginative writers have conceived of cancer and patients dealing with it, as well as photographers and painters. So I don't reproduce photography or painting in the book, but it's easily found on the web. And there's some remarkable work out there.
Can you elaborate on two pieces of what you just talked about? Number one, looking at some different memoirs and how others have talked about cancer. Can you pull out a couple of examples of that? And number two, I'd love to go a little bit more in depth on what you describe as imaginative writers, the cancer canon, and how cancer has been discussed in literature over the years. I'd love for you to just dive in a little bit more on both of those, Susan. Fascinating.
Well, the memoir that I discuss in detail is about a prostate cancer survivor, Michael Korda. And I was particularly interested in that because I went to a prostate cancer survivor group. I was invited to speak and to talk with the men in this group. And it was very striking to me when I went that the men had a great deal of difficulty finding language to discuss incontinence and impotence. Some of them had brought their wives with them, and the wives helped out if they could, but it was clearly a very difficult problem for this group of survivors. And Michael Korda manages to do this, and he does it in a way that is honest and clarifying, doesn't sugarcoat, but helps you understand what kinds of things you can do to help yourself in those circumstances. I was very impressed with his sensitivity and his willingness and his attempt to educate men to talk about these issues. I think that women find it more. It's clearly easier. If you look at the number of breast cancer memoirs, there are enormous numbers. And the prostate cancer memoirs I found were maybe two or three. I found that interesting.
Yeah, that is certainly interesting. And, I'll be honest, we see the same, ratios reflected in our support groups at our centers around the country. We certainly have a much larger percentage of women who are participating in our support groups than men. But interestingly, we find more men who are tapping into some of our services online, and that may be because there's an anonymity to it, and they appreciate that sort of online opportunity to be a little bit more anonymous in connecting with others, showing they still really desire the connection, but they're looking for ways to do it that feel a little bit more more comfortable for them. So, Susan, take us a little more into the next chapter where you talk about, the quote-unquote imaginative writers, cancer in fiction. Tell us about some of the analysis there and what you've, observed in that analysis.
Well, I think that the standard is still Tolstoy's Death of Ivan Illich. I think it's an incredible short story that teaches us something about the experience of loneliness, especially when disease is denied. I mean, his doctors and his family are trying to say that he's not really that sick and that if he just takes his medicine, he'll be fine. And this encases him in a kind of loneliness that is extremely difficult for him to break out of. The other great story about cancer, it seems to me, is by Tilly Olson, Tell Me a Riddle. Although I would want to say to readers and to listeners that Laurie Moore and Alice Munro have produced marvelous short stories that I discuss in the book about surviving with cancer and about dealing with hospital language and about even the issue of a child sick with disease. I think what's interesting about this, very often what's interesting about imaginative literature is its interest in time. It suggests that once we get a cancer diagnosis, our sense of temporality changes, that the diagnosis and then the prognosis makes us feel as if we can't tell about our own future. It's a radically shifting future. It could be radically foreshortened. It might be extended. We don't know. Now, this is clearly the case for every human being who's alive, but somehow the disease of cancer, especially if it's a difficult-to-treat cancer,
yes,
pancreatic cancer, lung cancer, certain lung cancers, ovarian cancer, it seems to me that it really shapes, and imaginative writers are very aware of this, a kind of shifting sense of time, a sense that we're on a floating bridge and as if we could just drop down at any moment through a slat.
You know, I know in the book you wrote that C.S. Lewis said, "We read to know we are not alone." And, you know, I find that very interesting because certainly our motto at the Cancer Support Community is so that no one faces cancer alone. And so many of the programs that we have are really about, you know, allowing folks the chance to connect with one another. We know that the literature in our world in psychosocial oncology says that the three most common stressors that people experience when diagnosed with cancer is a loss of hope, a loss of control, and a sense of isolation. And it seems to me that writing in many ways becomes a formula to address all three of those things, a loss of control, a loss of hope, and a sense of isolation. It seems to me that writing could be a real tool or a vehicle to help folks address all three of those. Is that, would you agree?
I would agree. I would also add reading because, you know, reading is also a way of connecting with other people imaginatively. I mean, we think of books as an escape from experience, but very often we're escaping into somebody else's experience. We feel a certain kind of empathy with that other person, and then we reconnect with our own experiences in a different perspective. So Proust called the authors that he read his best friends. His truest form of friendship was with the authors of the books that he was reading. So I think that reading is also a way of connecting and of feeling less alone. But writing is a more active. I think what you're getting at is that writing is a more active way of connecting, and you can connect literally with other people. I mean, many cancer patients like me, I started writing letters to my daughter after my diagnosis, just reminding myself. I've never given them to them. I mean, I may give it to them. It'll now become a long letter. I may give these letters to my daughters when I'm dying. But for me, it was a way of remembering our shared holidays, our misadventures on vacations, our cooking mishaps, our sports events, their theatrical, you know what I'm saying? So it's a way of connecting with your children. Or some people feel that they want to write their own obituary.
Yes.
I write about that in the book, about how you can write a self obituary. You can write your own memorial if you want. And those words will be spoken, if not heard by you, heard by those you loved. So there's all kinds of writing venues available to people that will connect them to the people that they love and who love them.
Well, and I think the you know, the reading and the writing piece, it's such a critical joining of those two because, you know, I've taken over the years some writing classes, and what's the first thing they tell you to do when you take a writing class is to read.
Read
and get connected to language and look how thoughts and words are put together and see what inspires you and see what sparks you. And so, you know, perhaps the more, you know, the more we read, the more we'll have the inspiration to write as well. Susan, we're coming up on our break in a couple minutes, but I just want you to quickly go back over if folks maybe just are joining us and they're saying, oh, wow, this sounds great, but I really have no idea how to get started. Can you go back through a couple of those assignments and springboards that you mentioned for our listeners, if they're thinking maybe when they, you know, hang up from the show today, they might want to go and say, yeah, I'm going to get started. I'm going to find that 20 minutes right now. Now what do I need?
Well, I think you just touched on one springboard, which is if you read, you might want to write about what you read. If you look at a painting, you might want to write about what you see in that painting. And if you listen to a piece of music, you might want to write down just feelings that you have when you hear it. But I also think here's one that I used myself very often. Untie the strands of a domestic or work-related knot created by treatment. I mean, it's very difficult. When you have a child with leukemia, it is very difficult to work at the same time as you're going to the clinic every week or twice a week or four times a week, right? I mean, there are ways in which you have specific problems as a patient or as a caregiver of patients that it may help to really just sit down and say, well, I'll do it this way or I could try it that way. Here's another one. Itemize the equipment, pills, paraphernalia you have acquired. God knows I have a lot of equipment and paraphernalia. Describe the catheter attached to your body.
Yeah. Those are great, I think, great prompts and some things for folks to think about. This is Frankly Speaking About Cancer. We're talking about the healing power of words. We have a lot more to cover with our guest, Susan Goober. We're going to take a quick break here, but please don't go away. We will be right back.
Cancer. It's a lonely word. Terms I don't understand. Choices I never thought I'd have to make. But there is hope and help.
Support from cancer survivors.
Links to research and clinical trials.
Help with finances and access to care.
All behind you at Breakaway from Cancer, created by Amgen to empower cancer patients.
The cancer support community is proud to be a partner of Breakaway from Cancer.
Hi, I'm Nick Nicolaides, President and CEO of Morphotech, and we're delighted to be a sponsor of Cancer Support Community's Frankly Speaking About Cancer series. Morphotech and its parent company, Eisai, are committed to human healthcare, and we recognize that patients and their families are the most important participants in the healthcare process. We salute our global advocacy partners who are devoted to improving the lives of people touched by cancer every day.
Effective cancer treatment requires more than just medication or surgery. For the country's 12 million cancer survivors and their loved ones, the social and emotional challenges of adapting to life with cancer are ongoing. How to handle coworkers' questions, how to get comfortable with new physical realities, how to reassure worried family members, or explain to friends your priorities have changed. The cancer support community is ready to help by providing free counseling, education, and hope for survivors and their caregivers. Whether online or at over 100 locations around the world, the cancer support community is ready to offer the support you need to live a better life with cancer. For more information on support groups, publications, nutrition, exercise programs, and more, call 1-888-793-9355 or visit us online at www.cancersupportcommunity.org. That's cancersupportcommunity.org. The Cancer Support Community, a global network of education and hope. You're listening to Frankly Speaking About Cancer with the Cancer Support Community, an inspirational program offering the resources you need to live a better life with cancer. Now here's your host, Kim Tibaldo, President and CEO of the Cancer Support Community.
Welcome back to Frankly Speaking About Cancer, sponsored in part today by EMD Serono and Takeda Oncology. We've been having a great show today about how writing and reading about cancer creates a path to hearing. We're going to continue with our guest, Susan Goober, author of Reading and Writing Cancer and the New York Times blog, Living with Cancer. A couple times, Susan, through the show, you've sort of thrown out the phrase patient and caregiver. And we do the same here at the Cancer Support Community. But let's just talk for a moment about the caregivers. We certainly talked about how patients can benefit from this, but I imagine that this can be something that the caregivers can also benefit from tremendously, particularly because the caregivers oftentimes are the ones who need to keep going. They need to get the house awake. They need to get the kids out the door. They need to do the research. They take their loved one. The loved one can say, I'm not getting up today. I'm staying under the covers. I don't want to see anybody. I don't want to talk to anybody. But the caregiver does not have that option, and they just need to keep things moving forward. So in some ways, this may be an equally or perhaps even more powerful tool for them.
I completely agree. I talk about two memoirs that were written by caregivers. Leanne Schreiber was taking care of her mother, and Gerda Lerner was taking care of her husband. And I think that the caregiver can find as much solace and support as the cancer patient in writing. And in some ways, Leanne Schreiber says that it reminded her that she was not the patient. Mm-hmm. And that was helpful to her. It gave her a certain kind of distance. She was caring for her mother till the end, mm-hmm. lovingly, devotedly. But mm-hmm. she had to remind herself through the writing that she was not herself dying. And it was very helpful in that regard.
Mm-hmm. It's fascinating. Yeah, I just know that sometimes when I have the privilege to attend some of our support groups around the country, I find sometimes the caregiver groups can actually be more emotionally charged than the patient groups, because it's maybe just a safe place where folks can really express some of the true things that they're feeling. And even though that person may be, you know, your loved one who has cancer, the person also still is your husband, right? And you have good days and bad days and up days and down days. And you just need some outlet for expressing those things without folks thinking maybe you're a terrible person, you know. And certainly the writing becomes a very private way that folks can maybe do that and have that expression. Susan, let's tell our listeners where they can find your blog, your New York Times blog, Living with Cancer, and also how they can find your book, Reading and Writing Cancer.
Well, I don't really know the answer to those questions. I would assume that they can find the book on Amazon.com, mm-hmm. And in bookstores, I would hope. I find my blog by typing in either my name or the blog's name, Living with Cancer. I don't have any other, I mean, if you go to the New York Times page, mm-hmm. It's in the well section.
Great. Terrific. Terrific. And, Susan, as we get towards the end of the show, just again, let our listeners know if they pick up the book, Reading and Writing Cancer, what can they expect to find in the book, and what do you hope they will take away from reading the book?
I hope that they will learn ways to express themselves, and through that self-expression, find some clarity about their condition, whether it's worsening or improving. I think it's important to remember that historically, writing has always been a marvelous response, an extremely cathartic response to trauma. I came to this realization first because I'm the child of people who fled the Holocaust. Mm-hmm. And if you think about writers from Anne Frank to Elie Wiesel and Primo Levi, writing was a way to gain some kind of traction on an unimaginable disaster. Now, I'm not comparing cancer and the Holocaust, but I am saying that for many people, cancer is traumatic. And reading and writing can help heal, or at least help one cope with the aftermath of a shattering shock like a diagnosis.
And, you know, Susan, I'll tell you that we do have cancer, have data that shows that some folks who are diagnosed with cancer do experience the same level of trauma and distress as those who witnessed 9/11 and as those who lived through Hurricane Katrina. So we certainly know that it can be an incredibly, traumatic experience. And so to really be dealing with what can be similar to PTSD and finding some outlets and vehicles to deal with that is important. And we certainly do provide writing programs and workshops at many of our cancer support communities around the country. And we have some wonderful writers and authors who work with us there and share their own experiences and really give folks some guidance for how to get started. I noticed, Susan, the dedication in your book is, quote, for those who survive and those who do not. I think that's very powerful and really encapsulates in many ways the purpose of the book. And really, one of the things we think you're doing is really to help people contend with any possible outcome of their cancer. But can you talk a little bit about that dedication and what was sort of behind that and kind of in your heart and your mind when you wrote that?
I'm so glad that you noticed that, because I did that very deliberately. There's a scholar who talks about the tyranny of cheerfulness, the idea that we are responsible for maintaining a good attitude or the right nutrition or the right exercise or the right alternative medicines so that we can beat cancer. And I think this creates a sense of guilt in cancer patients, that somehow if they're not beating cancer, they've got the wrong attitude, or they haven't found the right doctor, or they need to change their diet, or they're weight is wrong. The statistics tell another story. They tell us that many cancers are fatal, and I think it's terrifically important to acknowledge that. People who die of cancer are not losers. of the fight. They're not losers at all. What they are have been are patients who are coping as best as they can. So I really think that it's important for us to get over this upbeat tyranny of cheerfulness and cope with the realities, even when they're grim, by trying to help ourselves, see them, illuminate them, and enlighten ourselves in the process.
Yeah, beautifully said. We certainly at Cancer Support Community, it's, you know, we something we stay away from. Oh, you got to keep a positive attitude. It's not really, you know, in the clinical literature that's the approach that we should take. It's you know, how do you find meaning in the cancer experience for yourself, and meaning for yourself. And it's a very personal exploration, and it's a very personal journey, but it can be, you know, a meaning making experience. And folks who connect through our tools and programs sometimes have the opportunity to explore that existential piece of the experience. So I want to thank our guest, Susan Gubar, author of Reading and Writing Cancer, and also author of the New York Times blog, Living with Cancer. I would encourage our listeners to check those things out. And we think that you'll find something there for you to help you through your journey. I also want to remind our listeners that here at the Cancer Support Community, we provide a wide range of in-person, online, and over-the-phone support. We want to make sure no matter who you are, no matter what kind of cancer you have, no matter where you live, you know that you do not have to face cancer alone. Visit us at www.cancersupportcommunity.org, or you could pick up the phone and call our helpline right now for information, counseling, resources, connection, 888-793-9355. This is Frankly Speaking About Cancer. I'm Kim Tebaldo. Until next time, be well, do well, live well.
Thank you for joining us for Frankly Speaking About Cancer with your host, Kim Tebaldo. We're here for you every Tuesday afternoon at 1 p.m. Pacific Time and 4 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Health and Wellness Network. In the meantime, stay connected online at cancersupportcommunity.org. That's cancersupportcommunity.org.
Thanks again for listening to the preceding program brought to you on the Voice America Health and Wellness Channel. For more information about our network and to check out additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericahealth.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the preceding program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.